welcome back to another episode of the Open Paddock Rallycast. Tonight is episode 16.2 for Monday, February 20th, 2017. Why 16.2? Well, we tried to do it last week and had a little bit of a technical difficulty. So this week, we review all the news and events from last week's WRC Sweden, as well as from a few weeks ago, the first event of the American Rally Association National Championship that was up at Persnej. This is Open Paddock, the Rallycast. Well, hello again. I'm your host, Mike Shaw, and with me, as usual, are our usual suspects, Matt Kalish and Ian Holmes. Matt, I'll start with you. How are you doing this evening, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing all right, Mike. I actually had a little bit of a leftover of mustache ale from last week. It is a very delicious beverage that does not at all taste like the hairs on my upper lip, which is good.
That's an improvement, yes.
Yeah, I'd say so. But yeah, it is a delightful beverage, a local Long Island favorite, and if you're in the area, you should try it.
That's really cool. I do want to throw out that very, very kind of Portlandian, although it's Newport where Rogue Ale is based. They actually made a beer once based on the yeast taken from the brewmaster's beard. I know yeast like comes from all kinds of different things all over the world and all over the wherever. It's just kind of ew. But they did do it. Anyhow, Ian, how are you doing this evening and what are you drinking tonight?
I'm doing great tonight, thank you. Well, you see, tonight it's not what I'm drinking, which is a dark truth stout. It's what I'm drinking it from.
Ah.
And, well, we can tease that all we like, but I'm sure we'll be talking about that later in the show.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, that's some nifty stuff right there. Well, I myself am drinking just coffee tonight, but I did give it a little bit of Kahlua and cream, so you know, it's not just a plain coffee. Need something just to kind of perk me up, I guess. And it is in one of my lovely rally mugs that I've got from the guys over at We the Terrors. This one is the 95 Subaru Impreza that's on this one, so it's got the little outline of the car wrapped around the cup, which is kind of cool. So, like you, it's what I'm drinking it out of that's also important, but we'll get to yours a little bit later in the show. So let's talk some WRC stuff, guys. WRC Sweden, over a week ago now. Wow, that was a lot of drama going on in that event. Probably more so than we expected. And I want to first off say one of my favorite things that I liked about this rally was at the end of day one proper on Friday, we had all four manufacturers in the top five. That was a great way to start a rally.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great way to start the championship, because it's like through Monte Carlo and now through the start of this event, there's nobody really stamping their authority on everything. Well, I mean, Neuville is a little bit, but he's having troubles. So, but it's great to see so many different cars, so many manufacturers and drivers all in with a shout right at the start. It's going to make for a great championship, I think.
I think you're very right. What do you think, Matt?
Well, just kind of jumping off of what Ian said, we also had a really similar situation in Monte Carlo too, right, for the first day. And I'm really hoping that this becomes a pattern, right? What's more exciting than a season in which you really don't know who can win, where everybody can be on the podium?
That's very true. And I will also say one of the other things I love that they've implemented, it's in the third year now, or maybe fourth year, where they got rid of the split times in the cars. So the drivers used to know what their closest rival, they could have a couple of extra split times in the car of their closest rival, and they could back off midway through the stage if they knew something happened to them, or if they're, you know, if they had more room to maneuver. Now, they just got to decide on their own, you know, Do I have to push like hell, or am I going to be more reserved? And that, I think, also adds to it, too. So I'm not sure how we want to break this down. We can either do it day by day, or we can do it by manufacturer. I was thinking maybe kind of go the manufacturer route. And I think to start things off, really a massive performance by Yari Matty. I have not seen him this comfortable behind the wheel since, I guess it was Finland a couple years ago, where he beat Ogier, but only in the very end did he get rattled because he ended up having some brake issues. But all the way up into that point, he was just, you know, flying along and felt pretty relaxed. So it's been a while since I've seen Latvala this relaxed, and he got a little shaken at the beginning. Matt, you were saying something about how he hit some bumps that made him a little uncomfortable, but didn't seem to shake him up too much.
Immediately after the stage, he looked pretty shaken, and it took half the day for his stage times to really recover. He had a bit of a moment there. Was it the first stage of day one
very
proper?
Very first stage, I think. Yeah. Yes, he like leapt a bit too, hit a bump that he couldn't see, and just hit the ground rather hard, and yeah, it really put the wind up him, didn't it? I mean, at the end of the stage, he pulled his helmet and balaclava off, and he was dripping with sweat. He really was quite shook up. I've not seen him that shook up before. So you either see Yari Matty either really happy or really miserable. You know, there he was. He was really shook up. This was a new experience for me seeing him like that.
Yeah, I think what I liked about it is, you know, Latvala. What I like about Latvala is how he really wears his heart on his sleeve in being so honest about his emotions and whatnot. And he did admit right at the end of that stage, right? He was saying, "Yeah, I had a moment in Shakedown and had another moment in here, and I gotta tell you, I'm shaken. you know, makes me a little nervous out there. But obviously, it didn't take long for him to relax again."
Oh, for sure. But it makes me wonder if that's kind of a design issue with the car, or if it's maybe the way Latvala is driving. I'm not really sure if we could say for now, though. The one little bit of speculation I can give is that the RS is a little smaller than the other cars. It has a bit of a shorter wheelbase, which would intrinsically make it a little sketchier over bumps at speed. But I'm wondering if it's something that they can fix in time for Mexico.
Yeah. I guess that harsh bump thing does seem like something they might want to look into. But it might have been set up just for that stage, that run of stages, and just had it a little deformed. That bump that he hit, he wasn't the only one that was having issues with that bump. We'll get into the other drivers later. Also, in the Toyota team, Juho Hanninen, unfortunately, his event didn't quite go as well as Yari Matty. And for those that haven't seen, you know, Yari Matty with a rather dominant win after what happened in Neuville. He ended up not only winning, but also won the power stage, which he didn't need to. But I guess when you're that comfortable and that quick, might as well. Ogier did it so many times. And fun fact, this is the first time that actually Yari Matty Latvala has had the maximum points from an event since they implemented the power stage with the extra points. So good on him for getting the double there. But talk about Juho, kind of a little bit of a repeat of what happened in Monte Carlo, wasn't it, Ian?
Yeah, sure. He hit a tree in Monte Carlo, and he hit another tree in here in Sweden. Yeah, I mean, it's like just a run of bad luck. But like I said, we don't know if we're talking about the skittish handling of the Yaris there. I don't know whether that was a contributory factor on this, but yeah, he's had two rallies and two head-on altercations with a tree. So he's got to be feeling pretty sick himself. So,
well, I'd say especially so, being as he came into Sweden as one of the favorites to do well, right? Because he's used to ice rallying. It's what he did growing up. You would have expected maybe not to see that kind of error coming out of him.
Yeah, I would agree. It's he had all that time testing and all that, but you know, it's different than running a rally, and he said that himself. Even though he's had so much time behind the wheel of that car, it's always been in these, you know, test scenarios where you're repeating the same road again and again, and you have it all memorized. Versus, I mean, there's little need for a co-driver really when you're doing testing. You know, after the couple of runs through it, right? Mm. So, yeah, I can understand where he might have a little bit of difficulties as he gets up to speed. So, moving on from the Toyota team, let's talk about Hyundai. Again, we'll talk about the flashback to Monte Carlo. Thierry Neuville, what the heck's going on there?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the car is clearly dominant. I mean, that you can't see any more than that. I mean, that car pulls out a big lead very quickly, and if Neuville can stay on the road, these races are his for the taking. So I mean, apparently didn't he have a bit of a telling off from the team manager after his accident at the second super special.
Yeah, Michel Nandon, the team principal for Hyundai, he basically, Thierry was saying that, you know, it wasn't really hardly any mistake. He just barely nudged a tire on the inside, and that caused his steering rack to break. Well, Thierry was just saying that, you know, this is rally. These simple things can sometimes be a problem. You know, we'll get over it and we'll do better next time. And that's kind of what he said from Monte Carlo. It's like, oh, well, you know, these accidents happen. We'll just move on. Michelle, after, you know, the second time of having this happen at the same point, going at the end of the day two with only so many short kilometers left in the final day and not getting that win, he was a little upset, and understandably so. He's like, you know, he's got to have a change in attitude. We've got to focus on finishing, you know. And yeah, more than a little frustrated, I think, and I think very justifiably so.
Yeah, I can understand why Neuville got told off, because it's not the kind of behavior that you want to continue, right? It's the type of thing that you need to nip in the bud. Because that gets into your head as a driver. If you effectively crash out and blow a lead in two rallies in a row, there's a mental component that goes along with that. It's not just, oh, you broke the car, we'll try better next time. It's, is he going to maybe overdrive the car, trying to prove that he won't crash again? Will he underdrive the car to try and avoid a crash? Like, it's not... It's a bit of an unknown at this point. And I feel like as management, you have to step in there and say, okay, we're going to put a stop to this right now, and here's how we're going to fix it. And that's one of your jobs as a team manager.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. You know, you've got to get him to turn a page and get this resolved. Elsewhere in the Hyundai team, we had, of course, Danny Sordo showing that he's consistent still, ended up having a much better event than Thierry did, again, sadly for Thierry, ended up finishing a respectable fourth place, the best of the Hyundais. We still had some issues, I think, nothing really exciting from Sordo. I mean, I think he may have had... I thought he had a little bit of an issue with something halfway through the event, and, you know, I'm not remembering what it was, but it wasn't anything all that major. Hayden Padden finished back in seventh. Nice to see him finally get a chance to complete an event in the new car. He had problems where his power steering completely failed on him.
Oh yes, it didn't. Yeah. On day two. Yes, I remember that. Yes, he described it as like wrestling a 400-pound lion or something, didn't he? But, yeah, it was, I would watch the in-car for footage, and he was absolutely shattered from wrestling that car around. the first loop of stages on Saturday, and I believe they said that John Kennard actually took over driving between the stages so that Hayden could get a rest.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. You know, when you got a car that's designed to work with power steering, and this is the electric power steering stuff, and let me tell you, having a car now that has electric power steering, with these issues that I've seen from multiple of these manufacturers and WRC having on these, it's a little concerning about the reliability of these. Granted, okay, this is racing conditions, but yeah, these electric power steering things can be a challenge, and hopefully they figure out what's going on with it and they don't have any future issues the rest of the season. But yeah, Hyundai had a pretty good finish overall with the other guys, but yeah, kind of more mid-pack than it was right at the front like Thierry was, and just not a good position for him to be in, obviously, having to crash out. Let's move on to the Ford team, and or shall I say the M Sport team, and Ogier had to sweep the roads. You know, similar to gravel, when you're the first one on the snow, it's not the easiest, is it, Matt?
Oh, no, not at all. And you hit the nail on the head. It's almost exactly how gravel rally works. So, but instead of having, the soft sand and dirt that gets swept off before you can get down to the nice hard hard pack base, you're doing it with snow and ice. So the thing is, though, with WRC tires, yeah, they have the big studs, but the studs are kind of useless on snow. All they do is kind of like dig through and nothing really happens. You don't go anywhere. So when you're sweeping the road, you're driving mostly on snow. The studs aren't quite long enough to really pierce through to the ice bed underneath. And it's Sweden, getting down to that ice is getting to grip. Like the snow is worth almost nothing. So when you're sweeping the road, it's a really big disadvantage.
Yeah, certainly. You know, you're the plow, basically, and everybody that's behind you. You know, what's interesting about this event is that even though the second pass, you know, once you first run through it, you're going to be the plow, but the second pass, you're supposed to be that much faster. And Ogier still had problems on the second run through, didn't he, Ian? And there was a rather unusual reason why.
Yeah, yes, because I mean, we talk about the WRC, like, and I'm sure there are some people who actually think that there are only like about 15 to 20 WRC cars that actually compete in an event, and that's it. There's nothing else. But no, there's a big supporting cast of like where you've got the WRC1, you've got WRC2, you've got WRC, and in Sweden they have historic cars running, and they've all got a different track. The width of the track is different. So it's like the WRC1 cars, they are the widest, and the historic cars have the narrowest track. So
yeah, those are a real narrow tire that's designed to dig down, just straight, really cut through that snow and get to the ice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when the car after, so you have your WRC1 go through, you have WRC2 go through, you have WRC3 go through, and then you have the historics go through, and then the WRC1 cars will come round again. And the track that's in front of the WRC1 cars now is a narrow track from historic rally cars. So there is no clear line. So they're having to like, they all be jittering down the, there's not really better word than jittering, or like they're like vibrating as they go down, jumping in and out of the previous tracks set by the historic cars. They're not getting the grip that they could.
Yeah, so I think Ogier said something like, you know, at times he'd have one or maybe two tires would be bouncing in and out of the groove there, making it even more difficult than when he was plowing.
Yeah.
So that unpredictability definitely made things a bit of a challenge there. But, you know, for a guy that was cleaning the stage and dealing with all of that, what a great job in, you know, staying competitive, you know, with the times all the way up to the end. he finished in right on the podium again, third place. He did kind of resound himself that he wasn't going to quite be able to fight for the front. That last day, it was really close, though. We had how many seconds were separating the top three going into Sunday?
Going into Sunday, didn't Latvala have just 3 seconds over Tanak? I can't remember how far Ogier was behind that, but it was it 15 or 16, something like that? I can't remember.
I got it up here. After the special stage 15, so the last stage on the little super special that was on Saturday night, 3.8 seconds separated Latvala from Tanak. And Sebastian Ogier was only 16.6 seconds behind that. So very close spread between all those. And you know that Ogier was going to try and push on that next day, but he actually had a little bit of his own issue on that very first stage of that next day.
Yeah, yes, he did. He I mean, with the big thing about Rally Sweden is they talk about how you can bounce off the snowbanks by the side of the road. And there hadn't been any snowbanks to talk of on the rally stages so far. But I think on the first stage of the last day, there was actually some snowbanks there, and he bounced off one too many, didn't he? And ended up spinning down the road and losing 20 to 30 seconds to put him out of contention.
Yeah, that was obviously pretty frustrating. And not only did he spin, but he stalled the car and spent a few seconds trying to figure out how to get it restarted again.
Yeah.
So that didn't help any. So it was pretty much done and did at that point. Tanak, he had some sort of setup wrong or something. He was there right on Latvala's tail all weekend. He was actually gaining on him all day Saturday, just chomping, chipping away, seconds here, seconds there, and getting closer and closer. But then again, Latvala had a good enough lead ahead of him initially that he could be a little more relaxed. But it kind of all went backwards for Tanak on that final day, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the one thing that Ford gave us was the answer to the question, what do these cars handle like if you lose your rear wing?
Ah, that because, they did, with finally getting Mads Osberg back.
Mm-hmm, yes, we had Mads back on his first rally of the year in his brand new 2017 Fiesta. And yes, somewhere in the middle of a stage, he lost his rear wing, and he didn't notice until he hit this bump. And with no rear wing to hold the car down, he did a bit of a nosedive into the road in front of him. Nothing serious happened, of course, but he was a bit shook by that, and the front of the car was damaged, and the rear wing was nowhere to be seen. So he put out an appeal on Twitter. So if any fans found his rear wing, would they please return it, and they would be suitably rewarded? And yeah, the rally fans did return the wing. I don't know what reward they actually got from a grateful Mats Osberg, but he did get his rear wing back and was able to reinstall that, ready for the next day. But
the question: how are those things attached? You know,
well, I saw a photo of it, and it didn't look like it tore at a mounting point. It looked like it just got ripped off.
Yeah. Yes, it looked like it was like broken. So I don't know how they affected the repair.
Right. Because, it's carbon fiber. Yeah. Not the easiest product to repair.
Yeah, you just get some L brackets and some self-tapping wood screws.
There you go.
No, duct tape.
Duct tape.
No, we'll do one better. Speed tape.
That's right. The higher end version cost extra.
Yeah, it's made for airplanes, so you know it's good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Also cost then 100 times as much to get that FAA stamp that it's approved.
Well, speaking of the FAA, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good transition there. We also learned how well the new Fords would jump, right? Like how far would they fly over Collins Crest?
That's true. The Vargassen stage with the famed Collins Crest, we weren't sure what was going to happen because the cars definitely have more power, but they have more downforce. So everyone was wondering, is last year's car going to be the longest jumpers, or is it going to be this year's car? And, well, the current record holder as of last year was set by an R5 car, right, with Evan Brynjolfsson. So what was going to happen for Vargassen, Collins Crest 2017? That was the big question.
And the answer came not on the first pass through the stage. It came on the second pass, and Mads Osberg tied the record, asterisk, for proper WRC cars.
Ah, I see you said proper WRC cars there. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what's an improper WRC car?
well, that's not including WRC2.
Ah, right. So the R5 still has the record.
Right, so Brynjolfsson has the record at 45 meters. Osberg tied Hayden Padden's jump record of 44 meters from 2 years prior.
Ah, okay. Well, that's within a meter. I mean, it's about 3 feet. That's pretty darn close.
You thought you had me? You never had me. That's a Fast and the Furious quote, and it doesn't matter if you win by an inch or a mile, winning's winning. So, it's tough to figure out why they didn't go as far as the R5 car, though, right? Because you think that with the extra power on tap, they'd be able to do it, right?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like there's you've got more power, but you've got more downforce. So it's like I wasn't totally surprised that they didn't jump further. I actually thought they might actually jump a little less than I thought maybe.
Oh, really?
41, 42 meters. I didn't think they would be going 45, 46 meters. So it, we really need is Professor Patterson to be joining us on this and discussing this subject, because he's a rocket scientist. He should know.
Yeah, it's a good point there. Good point.
Yeah, I mean it's like when I'm totally getting off point a little bit, when we're talking about how fast the Bugatti Veyron is, you know, it takes X amount of power to get from to push the car along at 150 miles an hour, but to get it up to its maximum speed, it takes like X cubed amount of power or something.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's going to take more power than those cars have got to counteract the downforce that they're actually producing.
Because if you double the speed, you quadruple the force, kind of thing, right?
It's a quadratic thing. It's with rho v squared. So yeah, that's like density, velocity squared, whatever.
Our other scientist with us.
Hey, I have an engineering degree. I'm like a third of the way to a rocket scientist. Why not? But I just
pretend to be a rocket scientist.
I just want to ride in them.
the rally car or a rocket?
Yes. Yeah,
both.
Okay, that's the right answer. But actually, now that I think about it a little bit, are we getting kind of close to how far any car can physically jump over Collins Crest? Because there's that pretty tight right-hander almost immediately after the landing, right?
Yeah, there's a sweeper right-hander. So everybody, you know, you'll see them. They're always on the far left-hand side of that jump to make it across it, and then you know, so that way they can make that right-hand turn. So, yeah, you know, the thing that Mads said when he did that jump is he thought he could give it a little bit more. Though he said he went just a hair wide, getting onto that straight just before the jump. And here's one thing to think about, though, is all this extra horsepower doesn't necessarily translate into higher top speeds. Actually, the top speeds of the new 2017 cars is almost identical to the 2016 cars, if they can get all the way to top speed. Now, the acceleration of the new cars is phenomenally higher. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that might have to do with gearing, too, which also you have to factor in, right? you know, however they decide to do the gear ratios to see how what their top speed might be to get over this jump. But so Mads might have been able to go a little farther. I don't think he would have been able to probably do anything more than maybe tie Brendelson's jump. But and yeah, I think we're just kind of hitting that equilibrium. And this is actually a good segue into the canceled stage. Was it Kanoon or Kanon?
Tony
Kanon.
Yeah, right. That's it. That was on the first stage on Saturday, and then it was supposed to be repeated again. And was that stage 9, I believe it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's K-N-O-N, and however you say that in Swedish, I don't know. But that stage, everybody knew was going to be just fast. Well, not only was it fast, but it was kind of uninteresting and boring to a lot of the drivers because it was literally, you know, make a turn and then flat out. You're just foots to the floor, turn the wheel a little bit, turn the wheel. I mean, these guys are just flat out almost the entire stage. This is a new stage, by the way.
Yeah.
And was recently added, and they ended up finishing the stage with an average speed of 84 point something miles per hour.
Cool.
Is that what it was, Ian?
I believe so, yeah. I thought it was a little slower than that, but I thought it was about 82, but no, I mean, that's fast, and I believe that the limit, isn't the limit supposed to be like 80? Or have they established a new limit of 80 since then? But yeah, that was fast.
So the second running of the stage was canceled by the FIA. They said, you know what, too dangerous. We can't run it a second time. Matt, you said you looked up some information about previous speed, quote unquote, limits, right?
I did, but I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately. But basically, the way it works in the WRC is the top speed of the car isn't limited. It's an average speed over the length of a stage.
Yep, that's exactly. You know, the same holds true here in the States. Mm-hmm. Here at Oregon Trail Rally, of which I'm one of the organizers, and, you know, when we design a rally stage, we have to keep in mind what this speed cap is. And the purpose of the speed cap is based on what the insurance company, so the sanctioning body works with, is who provides the insurance. And the insurance company says that you shall not have an average speed higher of X. To them, the fact that you keep your average speed below a certain amount means that, you know, there's the potential of danger is only in that short little bit, that you might be going over that speed, but then you're going to be slowing down again and all that stuff. So I totally understand why the FIA did this. If they've had this rule of 80 mile per hour average for a stage for a long time, you know, that's not set by anybody but probably the insurance that covers the event. And even though it's, you know, you might not think that it's going to change safety in any way, one thing that I will say is that these new cars are actually quite a bit safer. Since they've made them a little bigger, there's actually more room in the car. They've actually increased the changed the roll cages and whatnot to allow for larger impacts. They're the safest they've ever been. And remember, that top speed hasn't changed. However, when you have one of the things that we found out with here in the States with some of the rallies that were at least run by Rally America is that the top cars are actually usually the safest cars. And really, we shouldn't be basing that top speed on those cars. Those guys that are racing at the top level, they're going to put the money into having the car the most safe. What you got to worry about is the guys lower down. And when we started this last year, when we did our event, the maximum average speed for a stage was actually based on how fast a two-wheel drive car would be able to run that stage. And that was a lower mark. So if a two-wheel drive car averaged more than 74 miles an hour or something like that across the entire stage, then we need to put in chicanes or something like that to slow them down. Which made a lot more sense because those are the people that their cars probably aren't built to the same standards as these top cars are. And, you know, obviously the FIA is going to have different rules. they have a much more stringent certification for the safety features in all the cars, and probably, you know, they only let the newest cars really kind of compete unless they've been modified in some way. So I guess it's a little different there. But the bottom line is, I think it's probably all set by insurance. It's probably been the same limit for a long time, and it just never came to light before until they had the stage that was just all flat out the whole entire way. But the one thing I do question about this, what happens when we go to Finland where we know that it's always fast? And they've actually, somebody did post after this event, they've had average speeds over this 84 miles per hour that they hit at this one on stages over there. Why do they let that one happen at that speed and not here? Maybe the laws are different or something?
The insurance might be different for different countries. It might be handled by different companies. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. You'd think that with the EU, they, you know, these would be mostly all the same. But anyways, yeah.
I would say it's like it's the FIA that that controls the insurance. So yeah, quite why other rallies would be having faster stages than Sweden, or maybe it is just the icy conditions. I don't know. Yeah, it's something we can speculate on to our heart's content, isn't it?
That's true, but I mean, it is well known that Sweden is the second fastest rally on the calendar. Mm-hmm. It might be third now that we have Poland, because Poland's very quick too. But pretty much your top three for speed are going to be Sweden, Poland, and Finland, you know? So,
yeah.
But the cool thing is we did get to see what the top pace of these cars were, and they're definitely very quick. Some of those videos of the cars going by on that Canaan stage, holy cow, is that fast. But again, the top speed really isn't any different than what was seen in the previous cars. I think they sound better. They're pushing more air, so you see more wake behind them with all the snow blowing away, and I think it's kind of make you feel like they're faster than what they were before. So,
yeah.
Anyhow, yeah. So results. Just a quick top.
Well,
10.
Actually, we have missed probably the most disappointing performances so far this season from Citroën.
Oh my gosh, how did I forget Citroën? Well, I guess because I wanted to forget. It's been so painful.
Citroën, the people who took a whole year off the WRC to develop and test and prove their 2017 car, haven't even made the podium with it yet so far. In fact, the best positions from a Citroën driver has been, well, Craig Breen at Monte Carlo in the 2016 car, wasn't it?
It was.
Breen was in the new car. He was in the new car here, so he's had two. He's the best scoring Citroën driver so far. He's had two fifths. He's had a fifth in the 2016 car and a fifth in the 2017 car. At Citroën, I don't know at what point Citroën start to get really worried, but they put a lot of time and energy into developing this new car, which a lot of us thought was going to dominate, and it isn't dominating.
Yeah, they certainly put the time and effort into that car. You know, all that time that they weren't competing, they were out there testing. We were even talking about how they had that, like Volkswagen had that little light, sensor thing that was obvious for testing the car's grip conditions and all that stuff. And yet, it was rather lackluster. Monte Carlo, okay, Chris Meek made a mistake there. But the car seemed like it was actually doing pretty well on the dry tarmac. And the slippery stuff, it's hard to judge Monte Carlo because that's an event that the conditions change so much. How much of it's the car, how much is it the driver? But here in Sweden, if anybody watches the onboard, Special Stage 17, it's the penultimate stage, and you see Chris Meek just trying to control that car, it's all over the damn place. It's like he, you know, the what was the wrestling the lion kind of concept? he had power steering, but man, he is just turning that wheel left and right, trying to keep it under control, and basically walking speed through some of those corners. It's so bad.
Yeah, on his big off on the Collins Crest stage, I'm blanking on the name right now, but he lost the back end of the car. He entered a corner, tail stepped out, and that's just where it stayed. He couldn't get it to come back, so he had the off. So it's kind of the same behavior that we saw in the power stage.
So yeah, there's a lot of serious problems with this Citroen that they've got to work very hard to sort out before Mexico. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what they'll do. But you know, right now for me, that Citroen is the biggest disappointment of the year, biggest disappointment so far.
I'd have to agree. And you know, the common factor that both him and Breen were saying about the car was that you know, the back end kept kind of snapping out on him, trying to control that back end. So to me, this isn't a suspension issue or a engine issue. You know, it's definitely about delivery of that power. It sounds like it's definitely something to do with the differentials and how that power gets distributed to the wheels. And the thing that I find kind of the most troubling here is we've now moved back to the active center differential thing, which is supposed to make that easier on drivers. I believe they can even make adjustments mid-stage. I'm not 100% sure about that, but the old, back in, 2008 era, they used to be able to do that. They had all this electronic stuff, and we've kind of moved back to that, and much easier cars to handle with that kind of power, but it seemed like to me, maybe the Citroen has the power, but it just can't do it without spinning the damn wheels. I guess the only thing I can think of, but you know, great job by Craig Breen, another fifth place, you know, doing the best of that Citroen squad. Once in the older gen car, now in the new gen car, he ends up being the best of those. And not an easy job when the car is that difficult to drive. So hats off to him for being able to keep it under control. Meek, we've had such high expectations both for him and the car, and that's where the big disappointment lies. And we'll just have to wait until Mexico on that, huh?
For sure, yeah.
I think we'll learn a lot more about all the teams we talked about in Mexico.
Still another specialty event, though. And the problem with Mexico is it's both high and hot. And now you get into engine performance in those conditions. And yeah. And of course, major sweeping that goes on there, too. It's, I don't know. I just don't know. But again, the exciting part is, I don't know. So it's something to look forward to, right? So,
yeah. It's like I said at the beginning of this. Any team can be on the top step of the podium this year. And that's what's insanely exciting.
Yeah.
I would agree. The other privateer we also didn't mention, Elfyn Evans, one of your fellow countrymen there.
Yes, yeah, he finished sixth, but he sounded very, very happy about it. That's equaled his best result, so can't complain there. And also, there was a lot of very positive comments from the DMAC people. The DMAC people were also very pleased with their studded tires and the way that those performed. So, all in all, I think that was a win-win for Elfyn.
Well, that's good to hear. Although he did have to overcome a bit of mechanical difficulty. Was it the first day? The first full day, I believe it was, where his car ended up running on three cylinders for a little while.
Yes, we had that problem prop up again in the M Sport cars. They were able to fix it, I believe, during the transit, and didn't have to fix it in service, I don't think. So I think it was only one stage, or maybe two stages, where he lost the most time for that issue. But still frustrating to see that happen again, and that does make you wonder about the reliability of that, right? If they keep having cylinders drop on them.
Oh yeah, it also wasn't the only repeating M Sport issue too. Oitanic had gearbox problems again at one point.
He did. He had a funny noise was coming from the gearbox. I don't know if it, how much it affected him, other than when you hear that sound, you're going to back off, right, and maybe try and nurse it. But it wasn't. They weren't sure what was going on, but they did at that next service. They replaced the entire gearbox, so and he didn't have any other issues. So it didn't look like it affected his time all that much, because that happened on Saturday, and that's when he was clawing back time with and catching up to Latvala, I think. That said, it was Sweden. It's a specialty event, but it's fast and it's furious. And
thank you for legitimizing my quotes earlier.
You know, I'm there for you, man.
Family is the most important thing. Which is the theme of the Fast and the Furious movies. Full circle, people. Bringing it full circle.
If they just could actually drive cars and not do CG.
That they do not do CG in those movies, sir. They do most of their own stunts, except for jumping a Russian car that wouldn't start between two skyscrapers. That was CG, I'll give you that. But the rest of it, they actually do that.
They drive through tunnels in Mexico. Right, whatever, dude. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Am I allowed to say that I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie?
Actually, that was the late Paul Walker. That was one of the things that frustrated him. I remember when he did an interview with Bill Wood years ago. He caught him at a racetrack and was interviewing him, and he was asking him, "So you know, there's another Fast and Furious movie going on." It's like, yeah. No, the thing that I just don't like, the reason why I'm out here racing is because we don't get to get behind the wheel as much as we used to. So as the movies have gone forward, there's more CG and less of the driving, actually. So, bummer. But
are you saying that runways aren't actually 47,000 miles long?
Exactly!
are you saying that a submarine can't keep up with a Lamborghini while it's plowing through ice? Come on, man.
Tell me that you don't also have an 18-speed gear shift
and five reverse.
It's pretty hilarious. Anyway, oh Ian, you've got to see one just for the comedy effect. Honestly, you've got to watch one, and you will just laugh.
They're so good.
Oh, shall we get to the results of Rally Sweden then?
Yes, I think we shall, Ian. Why don't you rattle it off for us?
Okay, so we know that we've established already Latvala won, and convincingly so by like almost 30 seconds. Tanak second, another great showing from Oit Tanak. One step further up the podium than at Monte Carlo. Do you think he could make another step up the podium for Mexico? With Ogier third, Sordo fourth, Breen fifth, a happy Elvin Evans in sixth, Padden seventh, Lefebvre eighth, and then we had the first of the WRC2 cars with Pontus Tiedemann and then Timo Suninen.
Now, so that's talk the about top, dominant that's drives. That Pontus Tiedemann drive in that Skoda was dominant. he won by just under a minute. But in WRC2, but it wasn't that close. He had stretched such a lead at the very beginning. He just kind of, I think, just drove it home the rest of the way. But I think that one was pretty much over by Saturday afternoon.
Maybe he could teach Thierry Neuville a thing or two.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Know when to back off.
Once you're out in front, just don't do anything to jinx it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But so great drive by him, and I love watching the WRC2 competition. It is getting better and better. And another one of your fellow countrymen that was out there in the WRC2 now is Gus Greensmith. He was definitely farther down the order. He was just getting experience. Eric Camely, who's been shuttled back into the WRC2 after being in the WRC. Yeah, he was in fourth place in WRC2, and yeah, I don't know what to say about him. He's not ready for the prime time yet.
No, but I tell you who I really liked seeing, simply because it's a different car, and that was Valeri Gorban in the Mini.
We have not seen a WRC Mini in a long time.
Yeah, we got to see him several times during the WRC coverage this time, and I like that Mini. So I was personally, on my level, I was really happy to see that. So,
I completely agree.
Uh-huh. Yep. Another one of the different manufacturer cars out there. It's always good to see that, for sure. Yeah. Speaking of manufacturers, that now puts us with a commanding lead by the M Sport Squad. 73 points for them with their consistently good finishes. Toyota Gazoo Racing at 53 points. Hyundai down in with 40 points in third. And Citroën way down with only 26 points.
That's insulting.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it's not looking so good for them. So a lot to make up there, definitely, for some of those guys. So what's interesting about looking at the driver standings now is this is going to be how they're going to have to start out on the long Friday down in Mexico with all the road sweeping. You know, people are like, wow, Yari Matty's so fast, he's so comfortable. Well, you got to think about start position. And it's going to be a bigger factor in Mexico. And right now you've got Yari Matty leading in the points, which means he'll be first on the road with Ogier behind him, a more experienced sweeper, and Oit Tanak in third. I really don't think we're going to see the roads really kind of clear until probably the fifth or sixth car, though. There's pretty deep loose gravel in Mexico, typically. And with the less power that the cars are able to produce during, you know, with that high altitude, it takes a little bit more to sweep it off the road, although the new cars are more powerful, so maybe that'll cancel some of that out. But you've got, so Sordo fourth in points. So you got Latvala, Ogier, Tanak, Sordo, Breen, Evans. Then you get Lefebvre and Neuville, Padden, and Mickelson.
Ooh, Neuville is going to be a good position, isn't he?
He is. Well, and Meek back in 14th in points. So obviously you got some of those guys that won't be there, but this is where Meek and Neuville can take advantage, and they hopefully will, and be back up there at the front. Those are the two we've been hoping to see battle with the other guys. So, that'll definitely make for a difference. Now, we had one other person we were following pretty closely out there at Rally Sweden.
Yes.
And that was one Louise Cook. You even helped support her way of getting there, right?
I did indeed. We talked about her last time and her her attempts at her crowdfunding attempts to get to Rally Sweden. Well, the good news was that the crowdfunding and other things raised enough money to get her to Rally Sweden. So she'd been quiet on Facebook for a few days, and then all of a sudden she appeared. I'm here in Sweden. Thanks, everybody. So that was really exciting. She started off with really good news in that she'd actually, as a result of all the coverage exposure she's been getting in the UK, she got a major sponsor, and that's Duckham's Motor Oil. Duckham's were a big brand of motor oil that supported a lot of sporting events, motorsport events in the UK, up until the 1980s when they were taken over by BP. And yes, the brand is being relaunched in the UK, and Duckham's are a main sponsor on the car. So that was really, really good news. Really good news to start with. But that was about the only good news she had, because she had a rather trying event, let's say. She had a role on stage two. If anybody's seen this on YouTube, it's quite magnificent. She came into a sharp left-hand turn, a little too hot, and plowed through the snowbank and rolled onto her side and kept her foot down and drove along the road on her side for a good bit before she before she came to a halt, but, you know, but because there were people there videoing it, there was also plenty of people to roll her onto onto four wheels, and she carried on.
If you are going to flip onto your side, the best place to do it is near a spectator area. So she lucked out a little bit there.
She certainly did, yeah. And then somehow on this was on day two, somewhere on one of the stages. Mads Osberg lost his rear wing, she lost her front spoiler, and she, like Mads, appealed to the crowd, to the fans, to return it, because she's on a shoestring budget. She needs to keep all the bits she possibly can. And the fans, again, the Swedish rally fans are wonderful. They returned the front spoiler to her.
Brilliant. So, right, that's awesome.
That's fantastic.
Uh-huh. So, and probably the most notable thing about Louise's rally Sweden was...
And most watched.
Yeah, was Colin's crest. Now, you can say that Mads' 44-meter jump was the highlight. But no, it wasn't. Not for me. It was Louise's jump. Because she, I think it was the second time round, as she leapt at Colin's crest, her bonnet hood flipped up, blocking her view entirely. She probably jumped about like 20, 25 meters, but she couldn't see anything from there until the end of the stage, which was about a mile away. So there she is, driving the stage. I know she's obviously not going flat out now, but with the bonnet up, blocking her view. Now this is the ultimate show of trust between driver and her co-driver. So we're going to have big props to co-driver Stefan Davis. That's totally amazing that they could drive that way, that Louise trusted him to tell her exactly where to go at the right time.
Can you tell me how this works as a co-driver? Do you sometimes practice putting a blindfold on and going through a stage?
I don't know how that works. I've never had to go across that. Maybe I'll have a word with Bill Marenich, who I'm co-driving for at Southern Ohio. Maybe I'll have a word with him before the event. Right. Hey, Bill, do you fancy driving down the stage with a blindfold on? I don't think that'll
Not necessarily a blindfold. Actually, they actually have a device for this kind of thing. As someone that's gone and received my private pilot's license, it's called a hood, and the idea is it just blocks everything, you know, up high, so you can see all your instruments. And you can see a little bit, but, you know, the idea is it's supposed to be like, you know, you flow into a cloud and you can't see. And so maybe that's the kind of training you need. There you go.
Maybe, yeah. But anyway, so we are still not finished with Louise's Rally Sweden. I mean, this is getting a lot.
Quite dramatic.
This is like what we were. When we were reporting Dakar, you know, we like listed everything that had happened to the whole field. Now we're just listing everything that's happening to one person. So the hood, as she leapt Colin's crest, the hood flipped up and must have broken her windshield. So at service, the crew removed the windshield from the recce car and put that into the rally car so that she would be able to finish.
Well, but I know where they got that idea, because that happened to Henning Solberg earlier in the event. He not only took it from it wasn't the recce car, because Henning actually recced the event in a van, a moving van. That was his recce car. No joke. And this is the Solbergs here. They're little nuts. And then when he was, he had the same issue where he had a broken windscreen, and he took it from a hire car, a rental. He took the windscreen off of that. So is that it? So she had
finished. I mean, it's better than a soap opera. This is, it goes on more and more. So yeah, they've, removed the, windscreen from the recce car and put it in the rally car, ready to go out the following day. But now this is the real heartbreaker. The car failed scrutineering on the Sunday morning, because one of the co-drivers, so the brackets to hold the co-driver's seat in place, had been bent in the crash where they lost the front spoiler. So they got some replacement brackets. these were actually stronger brackets than that were being replaced, but because they hadn't been homologated with the car.
Oh,
the FIA reps wouldn't let the crew compete, so she was forced to retire before the final day started. So she was devastated, you know. And I mean, you said earlier, yeah, I contributed to the crowdfunding effort to get her there. You know, so I felt like I was a part of the team, and you know, I was gutted for her. I was gutted because we were there pushing her dream, and here she was forced out of the race by bureaucracy. So that was gutting for her.
I've helped support a driver before, and they've crashed out and whatnot, and that's a lot less frustrating than it being because of a scrutineering deal. That hurts when it's all about, and something so insignificant, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like you know, they used some special injectors or something on the, you know, something that would add performance. No, this was seat brackets. I mean, come on. What performance advantage are you going to get from that?
A seat bracket that was stronger, allegedly.
And therefore probably safer. Right, exactly. Uh-huh. That's...
So, were all pretty depressed and disgusted by it all. So, yeah, she was pretty upset by it, and we were all pretty upset. So, but you know, the rules are rules. You know, if it's not a seat bracket, it's something else that could make a difference. You know, so. But yeah, that was Louise's Rally Sweden done.
Well,
thanks,
she's got right. She's had a lot of people following. Actually a great video on Red Bull, I think, had a little video that was posted of kind of some of what was going on with her over the weekend. And we'll make sure we put that in the notes. It was a pretty good little background on her. And this is her first winter rally. She's never done a snow rally before. So I think she said she'd done a little bit of ice driving before, but nothing like this. And so, yeah, it's always tough that first time out. And this was extra tough for her, obviously. So, What's the next event she's looking to compete in?
Next one is going to be Rally Corsica. So she's going to be starting another round of fundraising to help that. So, you know, maybe you guys want to put your hands in your pockets and support her a little. So, you know, the exchange rate is really good right now. Yeah, £25 is like about $30. What's that? A week's worth of some kind of like fancy coffee in Seattle out on the West Coast. Yeah, a week's worth
something
coffee
like that
would help her in her WRC bid. So there you go.
Well, we look forward to seeing what she can do next, and hopefully with that sponsor and the attention she's garnered, especially with, you know, never say die and keep trying, maybe she'll get some bigger financial help as well. So that'll be pretty cool. Well, let's move on to this continent, and we know, of course, WRC Mexico is coming, but we had an event here, the first round of the American Rally Association National Championship, which competed with the Canadian Rally Championship by going up into Canada for Rally Personnage. And I think there's no better person to give us some details on this, at least that wasn't there but was kind of pseudo there, and that would be Matt, because Matt, you were having to follow this pretty closely, weren't you?
I did some work for some people and
did some stuff with some people.
I did some things and some stuff, and I don't know. It was pretty sweet.
But, he doesn't want to say too much.
I know, right?
It's like you're really putting him on the spot.
I know. It's great.
So Ian, what are you drinking that that beverage out of?
Insert subject change.
But yeah, I ended up having to follow Personage pretty closely. And you know what? I'm really glad I did, because this is a really interesting rally for North America. There's so many unique things about it that just I haven't seen elsewhere. So first off, it's a pretty long rally for North America. It's 143 stage miles with just about double that with transit. But it's all done on a single day.
Yeah, they really cram that one.
Oh, yeah. The first, like, everybody leaves Park Expo at, like, 8:30, and they don't show up to Park Fermé until 10 p.m. So wow. We're talking, like, 10, 12 hours of being on your game when we're talking about driving this thing. And on top of all of that, there are only two services in the day. One is 20 minutes, and the other is 35 minutes. So
for the entire day?
For the entire day, less than an hour total of service.
Wow. And to add to that, the conditions are, you know, obviously it's a winter rally. They do allow studs there, but street studs, which are just little nubbins and not as much of a stud as you'd have, you know, obviously like in the WRC. But in addition, you got these massive snow banks. You got some roads that are more smooth public roads, but there's one out there that Pastrana was even describing it as being like a motocross trail. I guess what they were saying is actually it's a snowmobile trail that was ended up being used as a rally stage. So that's pretty harsh conditions to have only two services for.
Oh, yeah. And not only that, those stages that Pastrana was talking about, there are a couple of them. They're pretty deep in the woods, like no houses, no crossroads, just miles of trees and snow for the most part. And by miles, I mean, we're talking nearly 20 miles here for a single stage. And there are a couple stages that are that long. And when you factor in the roughness of a few of the roads and just the length, and I'm surprised people are able to finish it on their own. Like, just finish it, show up with a completely intact car. That's a challenge in and of itself.
Certainly. And of course, you know, in addition to the folks from the US that are going up and competing, we also had the Canadian championship there with Antoine Lesage, the one of the winningest drivers in Canadian history. And he was up there with the factory Canadian team. And we're really hoping for a close battle there, especially between Higgins and Lestage, even though, okay, we know that the Subaru Rally Team USA cars are much more powerful, right? Their budget is much larger than the Subaru Canada guys.
Oh, yeah.
But you've got someone with all this experience, and, of course, with that snow and ice, that kind of negates horsepower as being an advantage, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. But beyond just the purely mechanical aspect, too, you have the advantage of Lestage being on home turf. He's run Personnage how many times? Like, he's in his element on snow, just because that's what half of the Canadian Rally Championship is, basically. It's snow rally. So he's used to that style of event and the way you need to drive. Higgins, outside of annually running snowdrift, he doesn't really have snow experience.
That's very true. Very true. Well, unfortunately, we didn't get that close battle between them because it turned out after Lestage did end up leading after the first couple of stages, which were then repeated. But after that first run through them, that second lap through, he ended up having mechanical issues on a car that's been really reliable to him over the last 2 years they've had it.
Yeah, it's a real shame because so what you were getting at was that the first loop was six stages over the first three.
But didn't they have like a first two or three, and then they went around and did those again, but there wasn't
a service
in between?
So yeah, that's what I was about to say. It was six stages, but it was a set of three repeated.
Gotcha.
So we did the first three in the morning, and Lestage pulled out a pretty substantial lead considering the length of those stages. I think it was 10 or 15 seconds. And then he had his mechanical problems, which, I mean, unfortunately, he never quite recovered from those. He had his issues in the morning, got to service, and then had issues in the next loop of stages. And then he had issues after the second service and had to retire on the penultimate the rally. And that's a huge shame because this...
Yeah.
Lestage versus Higgins is something that we really wanted to see. It's something that... When was the last time that happened? Olympus in 2015? It's the last time I can think.
Yeah. Yeah, we had... Lestage did come in here, come over here for Olympus, did some testing. He intentionally didn't turn in his time card at the end because he didn't want to impact. He registered as regional, so that way he wasn't, you know, having to deal with the whole national calendar and affecting those guys. And then when it came down to the very end, he didn't turn in his time card because he didn't want to affect the championships of other drivers. So, but a strong showing there. Wasn't quite up to the speed and whatnot of the Subaru team then, but it was a car that was still under development at the time. So, but it was good on him on how he handled that and not turning his time cards. So, we do want to see closer competition between these guys. I hope that we see the Canadians come back down to the States. The next opportunity would be, the Rocket Rally out of Vancouver. Is who makes that, or somewhere in British Columbia, maybe it's not Vancouver, but wherever Rocket Rally is based there in British Columbia, they're the ones that make that Subaru Team Canada car. And that's not too far from Olympus, and that's why they come there sometimes. I'd like to see them at Oregon Trail as well, but I haven't heard anything yet.
Well, I can definitely say I'd love to see that stuff too, but worst case scenario here is we do it again next year, right?
Very true. Very true. So, first loop, Lestage is out. We had several ARA competitors up there. We had two-wheel drive. We had
a full national field, 13, 14 cars somewhere in there, which is a pretty strong showing for national entries at a snow event. So I was pleased to see that.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a good complement. A little lacking in, we only had a couple of two-wheel drive entries, but definitely we had the Subaru Rally Team USA out there. We had some of the restricted open out there with, we had Bill Bacon is back, so haven't seen him competing in many, many years. And,
I was really excited to see that, and to see him do as well as he did. So for those that don't know, Bill Bacon... mostly drove in Canada, did some stuff down here too, drove for a factory Suzuki team for a while, but then for the last 6 or 7 years hasn't done much. He kind of semi-retired and took a break, and Pierce-Neige was his first event back, and in order to do that, because he doesn't own a car anymore, he rented Pat Richard's old car from Rocket Rally in BC and ended up placing first in the ARA restricted open class and also second on the podium in the CRC standings because he was dual entry. So fantastic job by him.
Yeah, we had a number of dual entries out there. Now, the Subaru Rally team guys, they're fully backing the ARA championships. They didn't dual entry themselves, but of course, we did have Higgins in a dominant win. Pastrana did try and catch him, hopefully trying a little trick with some going for a different tire. Because he said, wait, doing the same thing that David's doing, there's no way I'm going to catch him, so I got to take a gamble, right?
Oh, right. So in the first loop of stages, Pastrana had had some troubles getting to grips. He spun a couple times once in front of a spectator area, so it was on the CRC live stream, which... Mm-hmm. As you were saying, if you're going to do something like that, always do it in front of a spectator area.
Right. Yeah, he got the most shares and followers from that one.
That was the only part of the event that I actually saw. That's why I've been so quiet in this discussion. I had other things going on that weekend, and the only thing I saw was Travis Pastrana's spin out on that corner. But can I just make a plea to the people who are using cameras there? Please, using cell phone cameras, please hold them in landscape format.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, come on, people.
Mm-hmm. Let's get cell phone video done. Great again.
Hashtag that, you got a deal.
Oh, man.
So anyway, Pastrana ended up losing 30 seconds to Higgins during the first loop, and he came in and said, hey, if we run the exact same strategy as Higgins is, we're never going to be able to make up that 30 second gap on an even ground. So Pastrana decided to take a little bit of a risk. He and his co-driver Robbie Durant noted a lot of snow, deep snow, off to the covering some of the deep forest stages. And jumping back to our discussion for Rally Sweden, if you're on studded tires, you're looking for ice. You're avoiding snow entirely. So Pastrana elected to mount snow tires onto the car in order to seek out those snow banks to drive through, because he thought he could do it faster than Higgins could do the same thing on ice. Very interesting strategy.
Did it work?
No. So unfortunately, Pastrana dropped another 30 seconds to Higgins during that loop of stages. So valiant effort, great idea. I know I wouldn't have thought of it. So it's you always have to commend out of the box thinking. It's
right.
Just a real shame it didn't work.
Well, you know, Pastrana, he's obviously eager to compete with David. The snow is going to be the hardest part for him to do that on. When he gets back to a little bit more familiar territory to the gravel and dirt, he's definitely going to be a lot quicker and closer, I think. So, and the other challenge for him is where he lost a lot more time is when they got to the night and you get to the night stages. It's just something he doesn't have the experience with, and that's where Higgins knows he can just stretch it out. And every time, Pastrana, like so many other drivers, are amazing at reading the road. Someone like Higgins is amazing at driving to the notes. So it's definitely the advantage in the notes, I think, that that Higgins has, especially in those dicey conditions. So good win there. The other kind of surprise there is actually we ended up having third on the podium overall for ARA was the winner of the Canadian Rally Championship, which was, as we know, not Antoine Lestage and not even an open class car. It was a production four-wheel drive car with an American connection. Alex Curiani, who used to co-drive for Chris Duplessis and for some others, and now lives in London, came across the pond back to the home world here and ended up co-driving for Crazy Leo Ulrichich.
And that's a name that most people should know that listen to our show, because Crazy Leo is a bit of a legend when it comes to North American rallying. No, not the John Buffum style, he just beat everybody kind of legend, but more of the, he is the most ridiculous man, and it is fantastic. It's that kind of legend. So one of the first things that Crazy Leo said, because he's also actually not been in a rally car for, he's not competed in a rally car for a couple of years now, he said, no, the car, I haven't touched the car in 3 years. Only women.
Oh, right. The best line of that rally, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I haven't touched a car in 3 years. Only women. Oh, gosh. Gotta love Leo. He's definitely a lot of fun. Then, of course, as we talked about, Bill Bacon in there and Jeremy Norris in the restricted open class. I think that was it, really, just the two cars in the restricted open up there. Mm-hmm. We had another just straight-out open cars, the dual entry of Boris Georgievich, who that's actually Lestage's old Mitsubishi, right?
It is. Yep. Georgievich also finished second to Lestage in the championship last year in the CRC championship.
That's right. That's right. So he's been moving up steadily. It's always fun to see him. He comes down for Oregon Trail and Olympus rather frequently. So he's definitely a border crosser. He likes to compete wherever he can, which is great to see. And then we had the first of the two-wheel drives. The winner of the two-wheel drive, Ryan Millen, with a new co-driver, as we talked about last time. Rhiannon Gelsomino sitting by his side, and they had a great rally. Although he had said something that I found was really interesting is, you know, he was driving with the studs and having no familiarity driving in these types of conditions. He did snowdrift last year, but it was with the studs. He's like, normally I'm looking for the snow to get grip. Now I had to drive away from the snow and find the ice because that's where I had better grip with the studs. So he had to kind of reverse analyze how he was, you know, going down the road versus what he had to experience the year before. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. And he evidently had a lot of grip because he won two-wheel drive by 20 minutes.
Yeah, how much? Steely had a lot of issues.
20 minutes.
Now hold on. Cameron Steely, you have to understand, he actually didn't even recce the event. He actually had somebody else do the notes for him.
Oh, that's fair. He's not as familiar. Somebody else.
Yeah.
And the somebody else was not his co-driver, Preston Osborne.
That is
correct. Neither one of them were there for recce. They showed up late. Yep. They were also a pretty last-minute entry to the rally, as far as I know. But so Cameron Steely, who was Millen's main rival last year in the Rally America Championship, showed up late, had someone else write up their notes for them. And it's in Canada, it's not like in the US where you also get Jemba notes. So in Canada, you're essentially making your own notes.
Yep, two-pass recce, just like the WRC, make your own.
Yeah. So there's no reference, so you have to rely to the notes that are written. But on top of all of that, Steely and Osborne weren't driving in their regular Fiesta ST. They were driving in their old Fiesta R1, which I don't think they've competed in for 2 or 3 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's... I mean, even though horsepower isn't everything... An R1 Fiesta, that's going to be tough, especially I think you're probably limited on the suspension that was on that thing too. So that's going to make it a little rough going, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But they still ended up finishing ahead of Dave Wallingford and Leanne Junilla, who were in their R2T16. So they had their turbo R2 out there, and they still couldn't quite match what Osborne and Steely were doing, or Steely and Osborne were doing. So,
well, it's kind of funny. They both had their own issues. So Steely ended up having a bit of a lazy roll on one of the spectator stages and got helped out. But Wallingford was actually pretty close to him after that until he got stuck in a snowbank on the final stage of the day. It took 20 minutes to dig himself out.
Well, okay, well, there's our 20 minutes we were talking about then.
That's fair.
So I guess it was a little bit closer than we would have imagined. But
getting stuck in a snowbank was Travis Neese, one of your local guys.
Yep. I got a little something to say about that once that's over. Yep.
Oh, yeah. Neese, not only did he get stuck in a snowbank, but after pulling himself out, he didn't have boost, so he ran the rest of the rally basically with a standard Subaru Impreza.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like being in road mode or something. Yeah, it's going to be pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, finishing it out, we had a couple of DNFs in the ARA list here. David Nickel, who's you know, Canadian guy who comes down and competes in a couple of U.S. events every now and then. He's got that Subaru Crosstrek. It's one of those Rocket Rally-built machines there. And he's got Rhiannon's husband, Alex Gelsomino, now sitting side-by-side with him. Unfortunately, they had some issues and didn't finish as well.
Also, not just Rhiannon's husband. Alex Gelsomino is also Ken Block's co-driver.
Yes, he used to be. If we ever see Ken Block do... rally events again. He's pretty focused on the rallycross thing, which, you know, has worked out pretty well for him. So,
well, that might explain why Alex is going to be with Nickel for the entire year.
That'll be good to see. I hope to see that Nickel does the entire ARA championship, or if he's doing just the CRC, I'm not sure. But it would definitely be good to see him in the States again. So,
oh, for sure. Also, quite frankly, a white and purple cross track is pretty freaking cool.
It is a neat looking car.
And just rounding out the ARA standings, we had Jason Bailey and Shane Peterson, who, and I didn't even know this was a thing until I saw it, but they were driving in a Fiesta with a Trailer Park Boys livery.
Oh, and I do know what that references to, so yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the shit winds were coming, Randy, and they ended up bottoming out the car on a hidden rock and cracked their oil pan.
Oil pan. Mm. Ooh, ow.
Ow.
Yep. Yeah, skid plates don't do much when the skid plate moves, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. Well, we saw that happen to Chris Meek at Monte Carlo last year, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, it happened to Troy Miller at Olympus a couple years ago.
Yes, it did. Well, you know, it all comes down to Oregon next. It's still a little ways away, but, you know, a good start to the championship, a good group of entries, and I hope we see most of these names come down for Oregon Trail next. But right now, it looks like, yeah, Higgins leading in the open class with, in two-wheel drive, you've got Ryan Millen leading Cameron Steely. Bring that battle back. That'll be fun. And then, of course, Bill Bacon heading up that restricted open class. So, fun times. Fun times. Well, let's finish this off talking with our, what we started calling this, the Rally Potpourri, our miscellaneous notes and things about a stage rally. The one I was going to talk about actually has to do with Travis Neese. There was a recent posting on their Facebook page. If you go to the High Camp Racing Facebook page, they have an image of a brand new 2017 WRX STI they're building out in open class. And it had like 8 miles on the car or something like that when they pulled it into the shop there at Ooh. Dirtfish. He's a Dirtfish driver instructor. So, they pulled in the shop there, they started stripping it down, and it is going to be ready for Oregon Trail. So I'm very excited to see that newer car. So we'll say goodbye to Snowflake. I don't know who Snowflake's going to. That's what they called the previous car because of its livery. And there'll be a brand new one coming up for Oregon Trail. So congratulations to that team, and I really look forward to seeing it. They obviously want to get in on some of those contingency winnings that Subaru has on offer. So the more of those that keep entering in, the harder it is going to be for everyone else that wants to take some of those earnings. I think we should move on our Rally Potpourri to talk to Ian, though. Ian had a little special something going on. Well, I guess it wasn't last weekend now. It was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Twist me arm. Yes, we'll talk about it. Yeah. I was actually out road rallying a couple of weeks ago.
Road rallying, just to clarify for those that might not know it very well, that's also called a TSD, right? Time speed distance rallying.
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
So it's not your competitive high speed first past the post fastest wins. It's more intense. You are given a set of route instructions. Within on the route, there are checkpoints, and you have to report to the checkpoints exactly at a certain time. So, if the first checkpoint is like 11.4 miles down the road, and you've got like you have to be there in 32 minutes. You have to turn up at exactly 32 minutes and 0 seconds to score to get a perfect score, 0 points. So yeah, and for every second that you are, well, for this event, every second that you were out, you were out of the time, you scored one penalty point. So the perfect score to win a rally like this would be 0. Yeah, road rally is it's a lot of fun. It's something that my wife and I have done for like several years now. We take my MGB out during the summer, and in the winter we run our little Ford Focus. So it's a great deal of fun. There's a very good road rally circuit here in Minnesota. There's a good winter calendar and a summer calendar as well. So there's plenty of rallies to be had. And I was just after Christmas, I was approached by somebody who we've all had dealings with Bob Nielsen, who does your membership and your media credentials.
Events.
Yeah, Bob, he's the one that gave me my hard card.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's the guy.
Yeah, Bob's a great guy, and he did compete during pro rally during John Buffum's days, and he said to me one day, he said, "Ian, you're a successful co-driver." Those were his words, not mine. And he said, "Would you fancy navigating for me during the Yucatan road rally?" Of course, I wasn't going to turn this down, because Laurie and I, my wife and I, when we compete in road rallies, it's like we're more likely to be at the back end of the field than we are at the front. We're more likely to finish last than first, but we have a great deal of fun doing it. But I thought it was going to be great to sit alongside somebody like Bob, who's experienced at this, and so I'd get some insight into how to turn our scores of 30 or 40 at a control into scores of like 1 or 2. So yeah, that was Yucatan Rally was out of Rochester, Minnesota, and it covered the gravel roads around between Rochester and Lanesboro. It's beautiful scenery, wonderful gravel roads. You know, if you wanted to put a WRC Rally America event on, you couldn't do much better than these roads in this part of Minnesota. They're stunning gravel roads, there's super stuff. So yeah,
houses and people.
There are not many houses, but there were a few. But
yeah,
you know,
all it has to do is a few, and then NIMBY kicks in. Not in my backyard, sadly.
Absolutely, that's very true. But so I was competing with Bob. I learned an awful lot about translating our scores of 30 down to scores of 1 or 2, because Bob and I, between us, we managed about 8. Perfect zeros on out of the 20 controls on the rally. So we were pretty pleased with ourselves, especially when we found out that we came first in regional expert class.
Whoa.
with a grand total of like 22, I think it was. Yeah. So yeah, we had a darn good day. I learned an awful lot, had a lot of fun. But you always have fun when you win, don't you? But yeah, no, it was an excellent day, great roads, and it was a lot of fun. My wife was working controls, and yeah, here's a funny story. Yeah, we were knocking off all these zeros, but every time that I came to a control where my wife was working the controls, we were a second early. So there's no favoritism there.
No.
But yes, it was a great day out. It's a great day out despite that. And I just want to say a big thank you to Clarence Westberg, who put the rally on, and his crew of volunteers, all the control workers, because they made for a great day, and it was a lot of fun. And I can say something that I would never be able to say if when I'm in a stage rally car.
Yeah.
I beat Nick Roberts. Nick turned up with JB Nyday, and they ran this road rally because Nick has some plans for some road rallying plans. I don't know exactly what they are, but they turned up, and because JB is an experienced road rallyist, poor old Nick ended up in the experience category, which he shouldn't have been in. So, we won our class, and I beat Nick Roberts. Yay!
Awesome. So I guess this leads up to this, I believe, drinking apparatus that you have?
Yes, the traditional trophy at Yucatan for a class winner is a big glass boot. It holds about 3 bottles of beer.
Oh, just about right then.
So yeah, it's that's the traditional trophy for the Yucatan winners, and that was what I was drinking out of.
Well, congratulations! That sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, yet to do a TSD. It's on my list of things to do. They just when they happen, it's always a schedule conflict for me, and I got to get somebody that knowledgeable to sit next to me to teach me how to do it. Never done one, so. Yeah. I would like to try and get one in this year at some point because I just love to get out and drive. And honestly, there isn't a better way to see some of these beautiful areas that we have in all of our states here in the United States when it comes to finding great roads. These guys that organize these TSDs, they know the roads. They've lived here for forever. They know where the best places are. And it's a hell of a lot of fun. And I definitely want to try doing one.
Yeah, the wife and I, we've also put on a few in central Minnesota as well. And the joy of putting them on is the discovery of the roads and the working out of the route and putting everything together. Now, it's a lot of fun. So, but we were talking last time before about how rally drivers' first taste of competitive driving is often rallycross. Well, for the co-driver, their first taste of competition in this way is co-driving on a road rally, because a lot of the skills translate very easily. The reading the instructions, getting to the times, getting to the controls on time, stage starts on time, and stuff like that. There's a lot that translates between road rally and navigating on the stage rally.
Well, obviously it's worked out well for you, and you're already slated to end up co-driving for the Southern Ohio event. No word on ending up at 100 Acre Wood yet, huh?
Not yet. No. I think you're getting a bit near the deadline, and I have other things going on round then. I'd love to do 100 Acre Wood, I'll just wait for Professor Patterson to get his car finished. And
yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully he can get that the old SVT Focus can be converted into that stage rally car like he was thinking about doing. I don't know. It's going to take a little bit of work, though. You got to get the cage in there and all that stuff, the safety equipment. But it's work in progress. We'll see how it goes. I guess that's kind of it for our main stuff. Matt, did you have any last-minute potpourri things you'd like to discuss?
At the moment, not really. Stop trying to pull information out of me. Come on.
Well, maybe we'll have some exciting news coming soon.
Oh, now you've just jinxed it.
Oh, right? Well, before we sign off, I do need to make a correction. When we were talking before, and I've done this in the past, and I don't know why, when we've talked about PMR Motorsports, we've, for some reason, dealing with Pat Morrow, just kept thinking of it like as Pat Morrow Racing. But, of course, saying Pat Morrow Racing Motorsports would not make sense, and the company is PMR Motorsports. See, I almost did it again. The correct for that is PMR stands for Pritchard, Morrow, and Rooney, and they're motorsports company. So for those folks at PMR Motorsports, I'm sorry. I know it's not just Pat Morrow. We're just mostly familiar with Pat. He's very outgoing. Anyways, I just wanted to make that little note there. And actually, we do have some exciting stuff coming up before Oregon Trail. We have the Sandblast Rally is coming up with NASA Rally Sport. That'll be the first week of March. And we have our good friend Jonathan Vihe. I think that's how you say his last name. I don't want to butcher it too much. He's going to be doing some live streaming for our Open Paddock Facebook page while he's at the event. So he's one of the volunteers there, been working hard to help them out a lot. And he wants to bring us some great content from that. And Sandblast is, honestly, it's one of my favorites on the NASA calendar. It brings out a lot of people and a lot of cars and motorcycles and what they allow, what the UTVs now and all kinds of stuff. So it's really quite the event. It does get a little rutted after a while, but it's definitely a unique one racing in the sandy stuff out there. So that's coming up probably the next really North American rally event, I believe. Because when is 100 Acre Wood? I think it's another week after that, right? So
yeah, it's 18th of March, something like
yep.
18th,
okay.
19th
so
of March.
Yeah.
Of
that one, so.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, me, I'm deep in the thick of helping organize Oregon Trail Rally. So always busy, busy times when it comes to the rally season. Anywho, thanks for listening, everybody. For Mike Shaw, for Ian Holmes, for Matt Kalish, we're signing off. Have a good night. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at Open Paddock. And take care.